Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to the Poison Pen. We are on event number two of today, September 2nd, and I'm very pleased to be meeting Andrew Piper, who is joining us from Canada. So, pardon me while I decline, probably your publicist wondering where we were. Anyway, Andrew, I find this really interesting. Andrew has a law degree, which culminated or climaxed much of his education, but he's never actually practiced law. So what was the law degree? Was it just for fun? Or did you decide that, you know, it was a good preparation for being a writer?
It was neither. It was a girlfriend, really. I had done a master's degree in English literature following a bachelor's degree in English literature because I just loved reading books and writing about books and thinking about books, but I never really thought about what's my career going to be? What am I going to do for a living? And my girlfriend at the time, I shouldn't put it all on her shoulders. That's not fair. But I was wondering, you know, do I pursue a PhD? You know, do I move into the academic field in one way or another? Do I push all this aside and just, you know, be what I was doing during the summers at the time, be a bartender? Should I just be a career bartender? And she went to law school, and this was way back. Remember that show LA Law?
Right.
And so LA Law was on, and it was cool. And it was that brief moment when lawyers were cool. And so that combination of factors urged me on to law school. But I recognized very early that I didn't want to do that for a living. I was going to finish the degree because I was brought up to kind of, once you start something, you have to finish it no matter what, which is terrible advice, actually. But so I finished it. But yeah, as soon as I could, I ran away to a small town and wrote a novel. Not with a view to, like, you know, this is going to make money, but just because I'd always really, really wanted to do that. And I was very lucky that book was published and published in a number of different languages, and it's enabled me that, and subsequent books has enabled me to do it full time since then.
So was that first book Lost Girls?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Which did extremely well. I can just read this. A national bestseller in Canada, a Globe and Mail notable book. Globe and Mail is the big Canadian newspaper, sort of like the New York Times, the same impact there. Mm-hmm. Was a notable book selection, in fact, in the New York Times Book Review and the London Evening Standard. It won the Arthur Ellis Award for Best First Novel. So let's tell people about the Arthur Ellis Award, because I just love it. I mean, I love the fact that it's named for
Arthur Ellis.
Sorry,
go ahead.
No, I was waiting for you to tell us.
I don't know. I don't know the story.
You don't?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, Arthur Ellis was, in fact, Canada's hangman. It was the, you know, hangman, because it wasn't a truly popular profession, often there was like a name, and then various people were the hangman, but they were called Arthur Ellis. So I've always loved the fact that the Canadian Crime Writers Association, when they started their version of the Edgar Awards in the United States, or the CWA Daggers in Britain, or the Ned Kelly Award in Australia — Ned Kelly was an outlaw, actually — decided to name their Canadian Mystery Award tier after Canada's official hangman.
This, I think, this is now ringing all sorts of bells. And just give me one second, because I'm going to show you.
Right. If you have it, you can show us the hangman.
Here's the accused, I suppose. And then it, you see, he kind of jumps around like that.
Yep. So now it makes more sense to you.
It's been a mystery for all this time.
Wow, how fun. I love that. And by the way, I want to apologize to you for starting late, those of you watching us. I clicked on the wrong link, and so I am the culprit. Andrew was on time, and I was late. And we are actually here to talk about Andrew's most recent book, right over here. And let me think. It has been described as legitimately creepy, recommended for fans of historical fiction with a bite like that of Alma Katsu. And Alma has been here. She was here with The Deep, and I thought it was that's a very good parallel. This book is called The Residence, and we'll go into why it's called The Residence and why Andrew wrote it, because I think I went to your website and I really loved your discussion of what drew you into writing this book. I mean, it can be described as a ghost story or a horror novel, but that really isn't what drew you into writing it, is it?
No, I came upon the material quite by accident, because I was recreationally researching, you know, Googling what we do, what I think all of us do now.
All right, that's just such a wonderful phrase, recreationally researching, which basically means you were just wasting time going down rabbit holes on the internet.
Bingo. I was rabbit holing. And for me, you know, my version, we all have our versions of where our rabbit holes lead us. For me, for some reason, my imaginative algorithm takes me to, you know, sort of Bigfoot sighting videos, you know, UFO lore and information, and ghost stories, haunted house stories. And I love those. I love those true account ghost stories. I can't get enough of them, even though they tend to be very repetitious. You know, they follow a certain form. But it was in that rabbit holing that I came upon the history of the supernatural in the White House, about which I was somewhat already aware. You know, I was aware of Lincoln's ghost and those kind of, you know, touristy brochure kind of stories that you get when you visit Washington. But I had never heard of Franklin Pierce, for example. And it wasn't Franklin that I stumbled on. It was Jane, his wife and first lady, Jane Pierce, who wrote letters. She had suffered, going back just a bit, she suffered, as did Franklin, unimaginable loss in the weeks prior to moving into the White House after Franklin's election win, when the third of her three children died in a freak train derailment, and at which she was present at the boy's passing, and he was the only fatality in this accident. Just weeks later, she is expected to move into the White House, which she does with great reluctance. And there she writes letters to her beloved dead son, Benny, pleading with him to return to her in material form. I mean, sort of not just sort of return to me in spiritual form, but she's asking him to come back to her. And according to her letters, he does. And that was the moment for me that my kind of recreational research graduated to real research. I was immediately fascinated by this woman, by her emotional state, her moving into the White House but not participating in any social obligations as previous first ladies and subsequent first ladies had, and the idea that here's a woman who, again, according to her own correspondence, had summoned a real material being from the other side into the White House. I thought, I'd never heard of that. And I thought it was very fertile ground to explore, hopefully with subtlety, explore other issues like American history, the crimes and atrocities that mark early American history and its foundation, as well as the idea that there's a continuity of the supernatural in this unique symbol in American life, you know, this residence where the president lives, when it's such a unique and troubled and strange building.
Yes, evolving even more history as we speak, strange and troubled, right. And I thought all of that was fascinating. I mean, it's true that Pierce, because we're in 1853, I think, when he won the election in 1852, is the one-term president. And we really don't know much about him, or frankly care a lot about him. You know, his was a 4 years that just passed, and then he lost the election and they went away. But what caught my attention, Andrew, and I can read this so I can remember it better, was what really interested you was not so much the mystery of the White House or even the evocation of the ghost, but the mystery of the Pierces' marriage, which was so unlikely. And how did their marriage survive that? You know, because losing a child often just absolutely sunders the marriage. I mean, we know that from, you know, the history of so many couples who have lost children. And somehow or other, they not only survived that, but appeared to be happily married, although they were wildly different. So what did your research or your imagination reveal to you?
Oh, that's precisely true. Yeah, you have this couple, this man, Franklin, who, just to focus on him for a moment first, you know, he was someone who, I sometimes think of him as the first kind of proto-telegenic American president, in the sense that this is obviously a time before radio and television, but he largely ascended through state Senate and then federal politics and ultimately the White House through appearance. I mean, he looked like a leader. He was very notably handsome. He had a good speaking voice. He presented well. People sort of saw him and thought, now there's a president, even though it wasn't necessarily evident that he had a lot of accomplishments or skills that would deserve that appreciation. He looked the part. And so I've written Franklin as a man who was trying to live up to those expectations. He was trying to be a good actor. So I'm going to be a good president. I'm going to do what my party tells me to do. I'm going to try to keep the peace within America, which is of course, at that time was greatly divided and was becoming ever more divided with every passing day. And he was absolutely the wrong person to heal that or to sort of solve that problem, because he was a custodian, not an activist, not an intellectual, not even a particularly good politician. Then you have Jane, who was the youngest of the Appleton girls. That her two older sisters were regarded as the beauties. They were much more fun at dances. Boys liked them more. They were noted to have big laughs, and Jane was delicate, fragile, didn't like to dance, was often sickly, had a range of maladies that she could sort of choose to cite if she wanted to avoid, you know, obligation. So, as you mentioned, they're a very unlikely pairing. Franklin, as Nathaniel Hawthorne, the writer, and Pierce's great friend noted frequently to Franklin, you could have had any girl. Why Jane? And Pierce's answer to Hawthorne was something, I'm paraphrasing, was something like, I was the only one who could take care of her. So I think at its heart, I think their marriage, like I think a lot of, frankly, successful marriages, was built on a secret. And so that's what within the novel, that's what I wanted to explore and create, is the answer to the question, why were these two brought together initially in their courtship? And how did they survive by all accounts, a very happy retirement together after their time in the White House, of an extremely notably unsuccessful administration? They had a very happy retirement. Why? What joined them together? And I propose that it was the secrets, both the grief that they had endured, because as you mentioned, it's an unthinkable loss that they endured. And they were the only two who could know what that was like. And secondly, I think it's what they endured in the White House in that time, that secret time. This is true, I think, maybe not this current first family, but I think what's unique about the White House is that it's a home, there's privacy, and yet it's extremely public, and you're either legally or by tradition discouraged from discussing your time there afterward. You know, it's a, so only the people who live there can really understand what it is to live there. And so in the case of the Pierces, I think it was a marriage built on grief, shared grief, understanding, but also a secret, an extremely dark secret.
Well, but when they were courting and first married, there was no grief because there had not yet been loss. So do you think it was that Franklin had some kind of caretaking gene that kicked in?
I think he did. He must have, because while Jane was, again, in his own writing, he noted her as being pretty, but he wrote with greater frankly, greater enthusiasm about other girls that he was, you know, sort of seeing or meeting at socials at that time. So I don't think it was her physical charms. There was something alluring about Jane to him that wasn't of a conventional sort. You know, it wasn't coquettishness. It wasn't her physical charms. It wasn't, I don't think it was a game she was playing. I think he felt that here is someone who I can take care of, A, who needs taken care of. But I think it's just, I think it is somewhat, in the novel, I tried to paint a portrait of them as being somewhat more complicated than that. It wasn't a charity case that Franklin saw Jane as, but rather that she knew something that he yearned to know. There's a deep curiosity about Jane that I think he found thrilling. And Jane's interest in the occult, which is evidenced in her later seances in the White House and her spiritual interest, I think that thrilled Franklin, who had a very kind of mundane imagination. He, you know, he liked walking in the woods. He liked playing, you know, sports. But he didn't have Jane's, frankly, her readerly imagination, her literary interest in the fantastical, the imaginative, the otherworldly. And I think he was excited by that.
That's really fascinating. So basically we have a kind of custodial, undistinguished president. We have a first lady who, instead of functioning as a first lady, was trying to deal with her grief and inviting the spirit into the White House. What conclusion did you come to about how successful she was in doing that? Was this one of these kind of self-hypnosis things that we see? It was very prevalent in the 19th century. People found that the veil between life and death was pierceable. If that's a word, you could penetrate it. Let me put it that way. Do you think she really believed that her son had come back to visit her and console her?
I do believe that. You know, it's very hard to gain insight into, you know, her letters are available, at least, you know, the one side of her correspondence is available, but she was extremely poor. Her penmanship is extremely poor, almost to the point of illegibility at certain points. So her letters are a mystery, both on the level of their content and what she really meant, as well as just, you know, what is she even saying here? But the way she writes about Benny's return is literal, you know, that she doesn't say, you know, I felt him nearby, or the comfort that I think many people claim to feel upon the passing of a loved one, that they, you know, they sense a presence. She wrote of it in terms of, he is here. He is here in the room. He's here by the bed, I think at one point she says. She's seeing him. And in material form, they are giving each other physical, you know, sort of mother and son comfort. I think she genuinely believed that the passion of her love and the passion of her summoning, her calling out to Benny had a full and material effect, you know, and so that again begs the question: are we dealing with someone, a woman who is not of right mind, or I think, you know, from my point of view, there's an invitation here to consider what if she was right in the sense that, not that, you know, that Benny literally came back. I mean, that's a question, you know, for certainly not for me to answer, but what if she was convinced of it? And as you mentioned, what if she was living at a time, as she was, when a lot of people were convinced of the possibility of that? So she could write this in a letter, or there were people paying top dollar to have consultations with mediums at that time. This would have been the intelligentsia. This wasn't a circus act. This wasn't a sideshow. This was considered serious pastime, and a very possible thing you could do. You could speak to the dead. And Jane took it one step further than that.
Well, you know, we see it. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle lost a child and very much went like Jane, you know, really, really delved into the spirit world and hoped that he could connect with his son and so forth. And yet, you know, he wrote Sherlock Holmes, the most rational of detectives. So, you know, it's possible. I think what I was also wondering was if Benny came to the White House, did she feel that he would follow her when they left? Was his manifestation only at the White House, or would he stay with them when they moved on into retirement, or did she let him go? Can you get any clues from her correspondence how that worked?
She stops referring to Benny in those terms, you know, that there's the summoning and then her reporting of the summoning success. And then there's sort of a, you know, she doesn't really speak or write any more about Benny's return in a way that, again, the abruptness with which she stops mentioning Benny, as a novelist, was an invitation to speculate that the Benny returned was not the benign comfort that perhaps she hoped he would be, that she was dabbling, you know, I think this is true of all, I think, not just horror literature, but the literature of, you know, of resuscitation, bringing back the dead is a very dangerous practice. It is forbidden by most, you know, most religions and most belief systems that it's something you should not do. Jane did. And those sort of moments, the moments when you experience success with bringing back the dead, again, certainly within the literary tradition, is when the trouble starts.
Very true. And it's interesting. We had a very good discussion with Joe Hill almost a year ago. He was here for our 30th birthday, which was October 3rd last year. And we talked about the fact that there's a resurging interest in horror as a genre that people are, and maybe it's because our world around us is so ghastly, that we take comfort in it. But there has been quite a lot published. Alma would certainly be an example with her book, The Deep. Yours, is this a genre that you feel like you're going to stay in, or is this a one-time thing that you feel you would move on to something else?
I think the former, that I think there is a lot of, whether it's historical horror, but it may be. For example, I'm working right now with the producers that I'm working with on a potential TV adaptation of The Residence into a TV series. And it would be one that, you know, the concept we've worked up is one that it would be a hybrid, so that roughly half would be documentary. So you would have experts, historians, as well as experts of the occult and the supernatural and spiritual mediums, providing a straightforward documentary account of these events or events like them, coupled with dramatic narrative, like I wrote in the novel. So it's based on true events, but there's extrapolations and enlargements and jump scares and fun stuff. So you're combining the fiction with the real. I think it's a really exciting opportunity. And in that case, we would sort of propose to tell the history of the White House through administrations and how each of them were haunted in different ways. But that's one way to do it. I think the other opportunities are, I would love, and I continue to look for, what will be the basis for today's Amityville horror, right? Is there, because I love that. I love that combination of true accounts that have a variety of questions about them. You know, is this true? Are these people looking to, you know, fool us? Is it a hoax? How can we ever prove it's true or not? I love that space. I'm happy to not know in a decisive way once and for all whether this is this actually happened or not. But there's something compelling in having someone provide testimony that I saw this. This happened to me. I felt this. I'm fascinated less, to be honest, less by the demons and the ghosts that I write about, but the people who see them. Why do people move into these haunted houses? I'm sure there's one in the city where you live, probably a whole bunch, that some people say, oh, I moved into that place and it was haunted. But the people before and the people after didn't experience anything strange at all. Like, what is it? I think fiction has an opportunity to answer the question, why them and not any others?
Wow, that is so fascinating. I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning of our tardy start here, again, my fault, when I spoke to Andrew about being a lawyer, because I too read the law. I And I'm a bookseller. I didn't stay in law either. But what I know about it is that it teaches you a way to think, and it also teaches you some very basic skills. And I'm hearing you talk about those. You know, you're talking about testimony, very lawyerly word. We're talking about, you know, research and research strategies and so forth. And I think the value of having the law background that you have assists you in writing the kind of books that you do. In the same way that I have felt over the years that the legal training that I had has helped me make better decisions for the bookstore than I would have made in the absence of having that. It's long range thinking. It's always looking for consequences. It's always looking for, because you know, so much of law is about the worst case scenario. You know, lawyers are mostly called in when things don't go well. And so lawyers want to focus on setting things up to go well, and you know, so that they don't have to step in. And I think that works very well for business. You know, if we do A, what will be B, and even more, what will be C and possibly D? And that seems to me the kind of approach you're taking writing your novels. It's legal training.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think what additionally interests me, you know, sort of again, thinking through a sort of a jurisprudence lens, is that tension between what is known. So here's the body of facts,
right?
As either, you know, sort of determined by a judge or what you have as a litigator going into the court. And then you shape a narrative from that. A novelist has a similar job, except she has to do that with some degree of greater freedom, where the only constraint really is, can I induce you into believing this fiction, even if it could be set in an entirely imaginative space? It could be set in, you know, Middle Earth, but it's less about believing that this happened, but it's that credibility test that I think a good book has to pass, you know? And I think that is a lawyerly challenge too. Can I shape a sequence of events, either on behalf of my, you know, in defending my client or prosecuting an accused, can I shape a series of events that seems this is the only way to tell this? And yeah, you know, so I think the good litigators do, I think, what I do. They just make more money.
Well, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, what I can certainly tell you is that a good litigator, he who tells the best story, the most believable story, the most convincing story, regardless of the actual evidence often, is the one who will prevail at trial. If you can persuade a jury to accept your version, your narrative, even if some facts contradict it, it's getting harder today because there's much more forensic evidence. You know, you have stuff like DNA and all, but before there was as much scientific evidence as there is today. Very often you would get, you know, verdicts in trials that could leave people stunned by, you know, how in the world did we get there? And the answer was because the winning lawyer told a really great story.
Yeah.
So I agree that, you know, that what you just said is absolutely true, and I'm fascinated with it. I also find that reporters, journalists come to writing with a different skill set, but also one that tends to shape how they approach fiction. So, you know, very few people are like a writer from the cradle. It just doesn't work that way. You know, most people have some sort of education, some kind of career aspirations, some kind of training, and then eventually, you know, write a novel. And then it goes from there. And I love the paths that authors take to get to be published authors. You know, we've talked to hundreds of authors over the last 31 years, and they're always great stories.
Yeah. So let me ask you on that particular point, you know, that body of evidence of hearing the how did you come to write story with so many people who've passed through your store, is there a commonality, or is your finding been quite the opposite, that it's just there's so many different ways that writers come to the vocation that, you know, what's interesting is there is no commonality. It's always a different path.
I think that there is no real commonality, and there are many, many paths. I do think a common urge for people who want to tell story is some wish to shape reality in a way that makes sense to them and then convey that to other people. But, you know, there's a real difference between an author with just one story to tell. We call them one book authors for short. And then a person who is a storyteller and a novelist and who will write. It's very rare, for example, that a real storyteller ever retires. Most real storytellers write till they can't write anymore, either, you know, or some life-altering event or they die. And then, you know, there are people like Harper Lee or Margaret Mitchell or, you know, whatever, who had like one great story and then they told it and then they could never find their way back. You know, they never could shape another reality that worked as well. I also think there's a big intimidation factor for authors who have a resounding success with their first book. It's almost impossible to ever live up to it again. And I think that can be very constricting. I think there can be a fear factor. And also there's a judgment factor that other people will bring to it, you know. So authors' paths are often shaped by how their work was perceived at first. I mean, you had a rousing success with your first novel, but you didn't let it frighten you or consume you or whatever, you know, whereas that's not always the case. So every author is different, but I do think that's the one trait that all of you share, is a desire to shape some kind of reality experience, whatever it might have been, and put it into storytelling form.
Right.
You know, it's been fascinating. We often, all of us, we've watched so many authors from their very first novel along. I mean, Michael Connelly, we did his first ever book event. Lisa C., who she calls me her institutional memory, you know, because I've been with her on the entire path. I mean, many, many authors who literally, we've walked the whole thing. CJ Box, you know, Craig Johnson, to talk about some more recent ones. It's what we've discovered is that success is much harder to overcome than failure. How people handle success can be a very difficult process for some people. And for some, it's exhilarating. And for some, they thrive on it. And for others, it ruins them. And I don't mean necessarily as a novelist, but it may ruin them as a person. You just don't know. So we embrace them all. But you know, so often people ask a question about process, whether it's where do you get your ideas, you know, the great question, or you know, how's your writing process? And I think it's a desire for readers to kind of try to understand what goes on in the writer's imagination and so forth. How is it that a story emerges? And everybody answers it differently.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the truth is, whatever your process is what works for you, but it isn't going to translate to anybody else. So every writer, yeah. I think every writer is unique. You have to look at it that way.
I think that's true. That's really interesting because I was thinking in a different conversation I was having earlier this week, someone was talking about this very question, and I'm going to attribute this to Joyce Carol Oates, but I might be wrong. But someone that I read was talking about how frequently authors are those who grew up either as only children in childhood, or de facto only children, which would be true in my case. That is, I was the last of five, but the other four were considerably older than me. So I was, you know, I had older parents and I was mostly alone because they had already gone. Or they are often children who were ill in childhood or spent time in convalescence in some way.
Wow.
And I was like, you know, I think that's true. That's not always true, by the way, but I think it's often true because I remember myself as a child, for me, I didn't see it as a challenge. I enjoyed it, but boredom was a real thing. And so I would, you know, wage war with boredom with books, reading books, writing stories. I had a, you know, a little tape recorder, and I would make up, I guess, sort of what we now call podcasts, right? Sort of tell jokes, stories into a recorder. And that was a way to kind of not be alone. And I think it's different today, but because of our phones and our sort of constant engagement, we might be miserable more, but we're bored less. So I think the writerly path is, I'm sure, quite different now than it would be for me at my age, because again, I grew up at a time when technological engagement of the kind we have now is just not available.
Wow, boy, that is such an interesting thought. When you were talking about that, I was thinking, flashing back to Robert Louis Stevenson, who, you know, was so ill and an invalid during his teenage years and so forth. And so to amuse himself and not to be bored, you know, he learned to write. If you read Agatha Christie's autobiography, she talks about she was a very lonely child and, you know, played imaginary games in the garden and so forth. And you're right, I hadn't thought about that, but that experience would not be common anymore. And instead of you entertaining yourself, you can now just draw on all kinds of external factors to entertain you, which really, sadly, if I think about it, may very well thwart the development of that kind of imagination and storytelling, because it's a lazy way of taking in stuff. You're not exerting yourself. You're really back to Marshall McLuhan, you know, the medium is the message. And he was so right that reading and writing are solipsist activities. You have to do them by yourself. Whereas viewing, watching television or whatever it is a community experience and completely different. Yeah. And if you don't have that solipsist time, I think it would be very hard to be a writer. I hadn't even thought about it. That was fascinating. Let me ask Patrick if we have any questions from viewers, because he's hopped over here. He's got one he'd like to forward, right?
Okay. The question is, can you explain a bit more about the rose garden that Melanie changed? It is her purview to make changes, but what's the protocol?
Oh. So this is a question about our first families permitted to make changes to the architectural ground, in particular the landscape of the rose garden?
Yep.
I honestly don't know. I am an amateur historian who has some knowledge of the Pierce administration, because of that was the period of time in which I set the residence. But in terms of the White House history as a whole, I'm pretty thin. I do know that there is one of the supernatural stories that is attached to the Rose Garden, was changes made by, and I'm going to fail to remember the precise First Lady who made the changes, but it was Dolly Madison who was upset in the afterlife by these proposed or partial changes to the Rose Garden, and it prompted her return to the White House as a ghost who afflicted the offending First Lady until she stopped work on the Rose Garden, and that apparently quieted Mrs. Madison's spirit. So the Rose Garden is a site for the supernatural, as it turns, you know, in terms of White House history, but in terms of the particulars, I don't know.
I'd have to really go back. I was at the first National Book Festival, which was in 2001. We were all invited, those of us who participated in it, to the White House for breakfast. And it was very casual. There was almost no security at that point in time. It was, in fact, a weekend before 9/11, where everything completely changed. And my impression, looking back on it, is that the staterooms are not subject to the First Family's decoration or whatever. They're private quarters. They can, you know, style as they want. But the public rooms and the Oval Office, to a great degree, are not considered family property. And I think I don't remember if it's a review committee, or I'm sure there's some federal official and committee that's in charge of the White House that runs the tours, provides the guides, you know, looks after all the public areas. And it's like Buckingham Palace in that degree. I've been through Buckingham Palace, and there are state rooms and public rooms, and then there's the royal family private rooms. And, you know,
yeah,
they're different. So it's the same with the White House, but I hadn't thought about outside the grounds. Very interesting question.
It may be those measures that you're speaking of, or, you know, whether they are you know, the rules against making changes that have led to it, at the time that Pierce was in the White House, it was not a very grand on the outside, but by many accounts, quite cold. The temperature, people would often describe it as being very, you know, sort of humid in the summer and very cold and damp in the winter. Hard to get warm, no matter how many fires you had going, whether that was because there weren't enough fireplaces or it was just the nature of the building. But it was often falling into disrepair. And by the time Truman was president, it was objectively a wreck, and in fact had to endure a tremendous, top to bottom, right to the studs renovation to prevent it from collapsing. So sometimes those rules to kind of protect tradition and this is the way it is can lead to no one can make any changes and the place just falls apart.
Well, after Truman, there was a huge thing when Jackie Kennedy became first lady, and she wanted to redecorate the White House. And it was a very much a trying to think how I would put this, not a committee, but I mean, she couldn't just do it any way she wanted to. It was a whole procedure and so forth. And I don't know how much it's been updated since she did that. I really don't. It's a fascinating question. Anything else, Patrick?
Yeah, I have a question. Can you talk about the Fox sisters and what's known of them?
Yeah, so the Fox sisters were the most celebrated and famous spirit mediums of their day. So in the 1850s, the time of the Pierce administration, they would have been at the height of their fame. And in fact, Franklin Pierce attended the World's Fair in New York, and his substitute, just as an aside, a substitute was a tradition at that time for, it would be a woman who would act as the sort of surrogate spouse to either politicians, male politicians who were bachelors and could not perform that social function themselves, according to the sexist expectations of the day. Or in the case of Franklin Pierce, a man who had a wife who was incapacitated. So Abby, who was a cousin to Jane, functioned as the substitute. And they attended together the World's Fair in New York. And it was there that Abby saw a stage show on Broadway in which there was a song talking about the Fox sisters and how they would communicate with the dead through a series of raps. The dead would sort of, knock on the table, and one, the younger, Kate Fox, would interpret, if there's three knocks, it's a certain letter. So it would presumably be a very tortured reading. You have to number all the knocks, and each knock, set of knocks is a letter. It would take forever. But they were very young. Kate Fox at the time was a teenager. Maggie was in her very early 20s. And they were stars. They were subsequent to the events of the novel. They fell into, Maggie in particular became an alcoholic, and there were a few people who, investigative journalists, who tried to prove once and for all that they were hoaxes. Today, history sees them as largely, we are in agreement that they were hoaxes, that the clicks and the knocks were caused by the sound of their joints. They had their toes would crack loudly if they moved them in a particular way. It was a funny thing in their family. And so they could communicate to each other through these clicking toes. Subsequent to that, though, there is still, to my mind, it's interesting because it's not a settled issue, because there were some recanting of confessions to the hoaxes that the Fox sisters wrote after that, saying, look, yes, there were the toes, there was the joint cracking, but there were real things that we could do, that it wasn't all a game, that there was something mysterious that we were accessing. And so I think they, I'm not comfortable today in writing off the Fox sisters as just, you know, sideshow game players. I think there was something, people described the performances they would go to see them do their act. And people would be fainting in the aisles whatever they did, there was something quite compelling about them that goes, to my mind, beyond a cracking toe. So back to the time of the Pierce administration, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that Jane Pierce summoned to the White House the Fox sisters to give a private seance or reading with the First Lady in an effort to reach Benny, her beloved last deceased son. And so that connection with the spiritual and the White House was, I think, you know, the first practitioners of that were the Fox sisters. But subsequent to that, we do know that Mary Lincoln had similar interests. And there's, again, a lot of evidence to indicate that she also had seances in the White House. And in her case, there is some evidence to indicate that Abraham Lincoln himself attended at least some of them.
And again, it was the loss of a child. It was the unbearable loss of a child that, you know, that caused that to happen, as I said earlier, with Arthur Conan Doyle when his son died. So, wow. Yeah. Andrew, what are you working on? Just to wind up, tell us about, I know you have various TV projects. I mean, this is not the first TV project that has come along, working out the residence in the White House, but what are you writing?
This summer I've been sort of working on a number of sort of non-book side projects. So the development of the residence as a TV project is one. There's a short story I've written that I didn't know if it was going to be a novel or a novella or a short story. And so I'm working with a different set of producers and a director on developing that as a feature film. And so a lot of the things I'm working on are not novels, which is unusual for me because I've been very fortunate that my pattern of the last couple decades has been write book, edit book, publish book, write another book, and on we go for 10 books. I've been sort of lured happily so far into down the pathway of Hollywood and TV and film and stuff like that. But I know what the next book is going to be. So I can't wait now that we're moving into the fall, I'm hoping to get to it.
So Andrew being in Canada is much more moving into the fall than we are here in Phoenix. And I'm from Chicago. So north of Chicago, which is much more like Toronto than Phoenix. And I do miss that sense that Labor Day and the start of September was a whole new cycle, you know, back to school, climate change, winter coming, all of that. Yeah. It was much more of a rhythm to it. But, you know, we'd love to have you travel our way when travel is possible. I would recommend winter. Winter would be a superior time. A good time to leave Toronto and an excellent time to be in Scottsdale.
I'd love to come, and I really appreciate the invitation today.
Well, you're entirely welcome. It's been fascinating talking to you. The Residence is really an interesting book. It is, in fact, our book of the month. It's our science fiction, fantasy, horror book of the month, and done very well. So we'd like to encourage you to purchase a copy. And thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.